In a shop at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, there is an unusual little book of photographs called Wonderland, a Fairy Tale of the Soviet Monolith. Jason Eskenazi spent years photographing the fall of the Soviet Union. The black and white photos are both stark and romantic. And like many fairy tales, they tell the story of the end of childhood. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Jason Eskenazi has worked on and off as a photographer for 20 years. He's not Russian. His grandparents came from Salonika and Istanbul. But growing up in Queens, New York, during the Reagan era, he kept on hearing about this mysterious thing, the evil empire. Once the Berlin Wall fell, he decided to get on an airplane and go.
I wanted to see history. I think I was not trusting what I was reading or seeing. I wanted to see it for myself, to go to the very source of it.
Eskenazi had studied the great photographers of the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, and there, in the former Soviet Union, he found himself transported into a world where many things were like the past.
No advertisements, less cars on the road, summer dresses, you know, all these things from 50 years ago, all the photography that I was brought up on.
He found few restrictions in those early days. He entered factories in Siberia. He entered prisons. Eskenazi traveled thousands of miles through 7 time zones. Not knowing Russian at first, he quickly learned the words for where is the wedding, where is the funeral, so he could enter into ritual and community life. We're sitting on a park bench in Central Park where Eskenazi has just finished his day job as the security guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He tells me the title of his book comes from Alice in Wonderland. You know, in most fairy tales, he says, a child experiences the death of a parent and is then forced to journey into the world. There's something similar, he says, when you think about the end of the Soviet Union, with the Communist Party no longer providing clothing, food, and security.
And when the Berlin Wall fell down, it's almost like they were set out onto the path, a journey, to find themselves, who they were, you know, after 70 years of sort of a childhood.
Often a picture in the book will connect with the next picture. A milkmaid in Kazakhstan looks out dreamily as she milks a cow, mud stains on her shoes. The next picture is of a young woman of similar features and age, but cultured and well-dressed, dancing with a young man at a waltz competition, almost as if the first picture is dreaming the second. A woman jumps up in a park, almost in flight, like the dreams of space flight that many of us associate with the Soviet Union. But the next picture is a woman dusting off a stuffed dog in a museum, one of the dogs that went into space. Eskenazi says symmetry is important in all of his photographs, as well as humor, satire, and yearning.
There has to be some edge of funniness, irony to it, yet it has to also have some romance and longing.
Documentary photographer Gene Richards says Eskenazi may use irony and metaphor, but none of it is pre-orchestrated. Most photographers today, he says, either do art photography or create blunt, in-your-face messages. Eskenazi's work is much more subtle and surprising.
This place that he went to could have been seen in a million ways, and he always seems to capture these little non-moments, and that's his ability as a photographer, as little lonely souls.
There's obviously a historical reality to the photographs, since all were taken between 1990 and 2001, after the Soviet Union broke up. But the book is also a subjective journey. It was during a terrible and beautiful thunderstorm in Moscow, Eskenazi says, that he realized that for him, the former Soviet Union was about the difficulty of losing what you always thought would be there.
We often confuse the memory of our childhood, I think. Like, even if it was terrible, even if you were in a horrendous situation, it was your childhood. So for me, the key thing was that they had a nostalgia for tragedy. That was the great lesson. That was my maturation.
Jason Eskenazi works at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where he sometimes stares at a statue for hours, contemplating life, art, and his next project. Some of his photographs will be shown at the Leica Gallery in New York between November 13th and January 10th. His book is Wonderland, a Fairy Tale of the Soviet Monolith. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
When a first-time novelist hears his work compared to Saul Bellow, Virginia Woolf, William Faulkner, even James Joyce, it must be both gratifying and daunting. Such is the case with Salvatore Scabona, whose novel The End is a finalist for the National Book Award to be given out next week. Starting at an Italian street festival in 1953, Scibona follows his characters, a baker, a seamstress, a jeweler, and an abortionist among them, back and forth through the first half of the 20th century, a period that encompasses wars, the Depression, and the immigration experience. Salvador Scibona joins us now from East Ham, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. Hi, Salvador. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Good morning, Lynn.
Well, I just have to start by asking you what it is like for you to be mentioned in the same breath as literary giants like Joyce and Faulkner.
Well, it's a little silly, isn't it? I mean, those are some of the people that I love, but I certainly wasn't setting out to write anything that was comparable to what they're doing. I'm just trying to write my book, you know. But I think that you are what you eat as a writer, so. It's pretty sweet, yeah.
It's pretty sweet. Well, the book begins and then ultimately returns to one day, August 15th, 1953, at an Italian street festival in a city in Ohio. And I wanted you to read a description of that event that begins, "It was a neighborhood."
Sure. "It was a neighborhood outside of which outsiders stayed, except for once a year on the 15th of August, when they descended in their tens of thousands. And there were the carny games where you paid a nickel to throw a softball at a pyramid of soup cans in the hope of winning a salami sandwich. In the central event, the Virgin was paraded out of the church and through the streets by men in white robes accompanied by torchbearers who until recently had covered their heads with pointed white hoods. However, the police, careful to prevent miscommunications and slanders, forbade them to wear the hoods anymore."
Tell me about that neighborhood and why you chose it and this festival as a kind of focal point for your book. Mm-hmm.
At first, I was just writing about people. I didn't put them in any particular time or place, and slowly they sort of acquired a setting. And then over time, it turned into a neighborhood very much like the neighborhood that my grandparents would have grown up in Cleveland during the Depression. But in my research, I discovered that one particular parish in Cleveland in which, during a street carnival, a group of African Americans who had recently moved into the neighborhood joined in a religious procession, thinking that it was a party, and started to dance behind the band. And the priest and the parishioners involved in the procession immediately shut the whole thing down because they thought that it was a sort of aggressive piece of blasphemy. But I think that they were kind of complicit in that misunderstanding, and I wanted to explore that from the street level.
It's interesting because you said when you first started writing, the characters weren't of a specific place necessarily, and yet in the end these characters seem so grounded in this culture of Italian Americans in the Middle West at that time.
I think of them as people first, and their Italianness is really, to me, is a very incidental part of who they are, although almost all the characters are immigrants from Italy. I was just describing what was in my imagination in a sort of a slow, methodical way and allowing my unconscious to fill things in. And as it turned out, I think, in retrospect, I think I set it in the place and time that I set it in because I admired my grandparents so much. And I had a very close relationship with all four of them. They were all alive when I started writing the book.
Do you think, too, as a writer, that if you do ground your characters in a world that you understand just by virtue of having experienced it on some level yourself, does that give you a kind of freedom then?
Yeah, exactly. I understood it secondhand. It's not a place that I know myself from my own experience because of the time difference. But I think that's exactly right, that in some way the idea was to get close enough to the thing that I didn't have to be making a whole lot of invented conscious decisions, and I could allow certain details to just sort of, you know, just come up at the moment that the story requires them.
Now, one of your characters is an abortionist. This is at a time when abortion is illegal. What did you want to explore through that character? Why did you choose to write about that?
I think that's a great, interesting example of the kind of thing I was talking about, because this is a woman who's relatively well off. And she had a personality, she had a soul, to my mind. And then events started circulating around the need for an abortionist in the book. And suddenly I had the answer to where her income came from. So the idea, the issue of abortion and the conflict and the moral ambiguity of abortion kind of arose spontaneously out of the soil of the book.
You know, to go back to what I was saying at the beginning about comparisons to Joyce, Faulkner, Woolf, those kinds of writers, I think those are being made because this novel doesn't follow a completely linear kind of structure. And I read that music influenced the structure, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, you know, I had a little bit of education in music while I was in college, and you often see in a Bach partita, for example, a short theme introduced in a very simple way at the beginning. And then the thing becomes more and more and more complicated, but you still have the sort of center theme that keeps getting repeated and repeated. Until you finally come back to an unambiguous repetition of the melody. And I think in some ways that's sort of the structure of the end, that you see this event, the August 15th, 1953, from one person's point of view, and then the thing goes backward and picks up six or seven other characters from the early parts of the book and brings them back toward this melody to this day, and it becomes more symphonic as opposed to just melodic by the end.
And one other thing, I understand that you were taught by Marilyn Robinson, the writer Marilyn Robinson.
I was.
And she is also up for a National Book Award for her novel Home.
Mm-hmm.
You're surprised to find yourself in that position?
I'm flabbergasted. I mean, as a teacher and especially as a writer, she's just been an enormous inspiration. So I pale to think what I'll have to say to her when I have to see her next week.
Well, good luck with the National Book Awards.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn.
Salvatore Scibona is the author of The End and a finalist for the National Book Award.
We're entering that time of year when holiday party invitations start cluttering up mailboxes and inboxes. Look ahead a few weeks into the future, and there you are attending one of those soirees, and you're tongue-tied and bored. Firouzé Dumas is the author of Funny in Farsi, and she's here to help. As part of our series, Three Books, she shares her secrets for how to snazz up small talk.
My husband's idea of hell is a cocktail party. As an engineer, he never mastered the art of shallow conversation, which I, as a liberal arts major, specialized in. It's just a matter of knowing a little bit about a few relevant topics and having a good fake laugh. I can't help you with the laugh, but all you need are these three books, and you will look bright and suave all the time, regardless of the topic. The Man Who Was Thursday. Just saying this author's name, G.K. Chesterton, will make you look debonair, like someone who knows his way around a silk ascot. His best-known novel, The Man Who Was Thursday, is a metaphysical thriller full of quotable lines sure to make you look mighty witty. But assuming your soiree demands more of you than just a quote from early 20th century Britain, you can always rely on the Tintin series by Hergé. My cousin Amin's biggest regret after escaping the Iranian Revolution was leaving behind this beloved collection translated in Persian. Tintin is a series of 24 graphic novels about a young, globe-trotting reporter. Be forewarned, the early books about the Congo and America are very politically incorrect, reflecting the Belgian colonial zeitgeist. Written for adults, but popular for all ages, these books span the globe, touching geopolitical conflicts and historic events, such as the Japanese invasion of China, the rise of right-wing dictatorships in South America, and the Cold War, all written from a European perspective. Even if you don't own a passport, but want to sound like you know your Russian from your Prussian, this all-you-can-learn cultural buffet of a collection is for you. But let's face it, it's not a party till someone starts talking about Islam. So what happens when you can't remember the difference between Sunni and Shia? That's when you bring up everyone's favorite mullah, Nasreddin, star of the Tales of Mullah Nasreddin. That's right, folks, a funny mullah. Mullah Nasreddin is a satirical Sufi who lived around the 13th century. He is a beloved figure in many cultures in the Middle East, all of whom claim him as their own. Mullah Nasreddin is a wise fool, a simple man who manages to outwit everyone. Bringing up Mullah Nasreddin will not only make you look like a continental wit, but also a bridge builder, someone who sees humor across cultures who can't agree on much else. And these days, anytime you can turn a shindig into an opportunity to make a bridge, especially when talking about politics or Islam, well, I'll drink to that. And I'll see you at the next cocktail party. I'll be the one with the fake laugh and the Kir Royale.
Firouzeh Dumas promises she's fun to hang out with at cocktail parties. She's the author of Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. She suggested these three books: The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton, The Adventures of Tintin by Hergé, and the collection of fables called The New Tales of Nasreddin. Dumas suggests the translation by Eric Sorensen.
After all these years, Marion Wright Edelman still has the fire. She founded the Children's Defense Fund to advocate for children, poor and minority kids especially. Before that, she worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on his Poor People's Campaign. That's one reason that Barack Obama's election to the White House holds special meaning for her. Obama was also a community organizer and advocate for young people. Marion Wright Edelman also has a new book called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. She came by to visit our studios, and I couldn't help asking her, if President-elect Obama came knocking, would she take a seat in his administration?
Of course not. I'm not somebody who could work within government. Everybody likes to go into government. Not everybody. There are many more people who want to be in the cabinet than want to start a movement from the outside. And I think that the gift that I have and the passion that I have is for bringing about a movement that is going to carry on the next phase of what we have to do to finish putting the political, the social and economic underpinnings beneath the political civil rights that Dr. King and so many others fought for. That's my life's work and mission. It is, when you're in government, it's from my point of view, I never could be confined. You have to speak for everybody. You got to be balanced. Children lack a voice. Children need a strong, independent voice that is just about them. And they are the weakest among all the voices. And so I just know that my life's work is to push and push and mobilize and organize as many people to get what children need. And leaders are made by movements. And while I am so proud of even the thought that Barack Obama will become president of the United States, he's going to be as good a president as we on the outside, as citizens, as mothers and grandmothers, as parents, push him to be. I mean, there's a famous recounting of a meeting between A. Philip Randolph and FDR when he went in to talk about the need for employment among black citizens and laid out what he thought the agenda was in fighting discrimination. And Franklin Roosevelt told A. Philip Randolph, "I agree with everything you're saying, Philip. Now you go out and make me do it." There are no friends in politics. And in the absence of a strong movement, when he's going to be battered by everybody who wants to stop the war or do global warming or do a new energy policy or do all the special interests, increase the tax cuts for everybody, not just those at the bottom, he's going to have his hands full. And so whoever raises the strongest voice is what's going to be heard. But unless we're out there with clear proposals, a clear constituency, and persistence and a loud voice, children are not going to be able to get what they need, and he's not going to be able to do all the things that he wants. So I think my role is an outside role.
We actually got the chance to talk in a different context, which was the enormous women's conference that Maria Shriver, First Lady of California, threw. And you were in conversation with Gloria Steinem. And I was struck by the reverential way that the women in the audience, mostly women and some men, how they looked at you guys. Is it a burden?
Oh, I don't take it all too seriously. I'm always moved if people think that I have done good work, but I'd rather them not kind of see me as an icon. I'd rather them hear the message and help. And I often get so many people saying, "Oh, what good, wonderful work you do. Keep it up." And I want to say, "Help me. We've got to build a movement." And so I don't take it too seriously. I'm grateful. But then the issue is, how do you engage them?
Well, you have this new book, The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. You reference faith a lot. You have some very specific ideas about that, about how churches and people of faith might serve kids better. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the mandate of the prophets and of the Gospels and of all great faith demand that we do justice and that we speak against oppression or harm to the poor, to the vulnerable, to the orphan, to the widow, to the stranger, to the prisoner. And yet it's so stunning to me that the faith community has lost its prophetic voice and have forgotten the dictates of all of our great faiths and have become, too many of us, puppets of the culture rather than challengers of the culture of violence and of militarism. What would happen if, you know, a third of these churches of God who say they worship a poor baby, I believe God entered history as a poor baby, would just see that they found one adoptive family? We could clean out the child welfare system. How about if 10% of those churches decided they were going to open up and start freedom schools, which is a model we've created for after school and for the summer, to give children safe havens from the streets? The gangs and the drug dealers are open 24/7. Our church doors are too often closed. What if, when we go to prayer meetings on Wednesday night or Tuesday night or Bible study, we decided that we were going to do something about 9 million children who lack health insurance and prenatal care for their mothers and are born at low birth weight? And what if we began to live our faith? I mean, churches and faith congregations, we've seen scandals. They hide domestic violence. They hide child abuse. And the church needs to get away from this prosperity gospel and really begin to reclaim what its faith requires. And so I think one of the great losses and one of the reasons why we've seen a breakdown of family and community and moral values in our society has been the silence and the failure of the church community, of the faith community, to speak up for those who have least.
You've got these four grandchildren. And do they understand what you do for children? And what do they think about it?
Well, my oldest granddaughter is 7. My second granddaughter is 5. And I have 3-year-old twin boys. And one of the proudest moments of my life, I read them books about heroines and heroes of the civil rights movement. They've read about Barack Obama. They know about Frederick Douglass. They know about Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, whom I wear around my neck. But one of the proudest moments of my life was taking Ellica was 5 when Ms. Rosa Parks died. And I took her when she came to the Capitol to stand and wait for Mrs. Parks, and waiting at the Capitol Rotunda as the bus came up, which sent chills through me. And then when Mrs. Parks arrived and watched the integrated honor guard get out and carry Mrs. Parks up the steps, it was just an extraordinary thing to be able to say to my grandchild, you just never forget, as the President of the United States was waiting there and all the congressional leaders, what one black woman can do and what one person can do. But we've got to teach our children their history, white and black and Latino children, and let them know they can make it no matter what.
Speaking of heroines, you have 2 women, as you mentioned, around your neck, Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, on these matching ovals, these kind of cameos almost, photographs, one on each side. Why are you wearing them?
Oh, because they give me strength. These are my ancestors, and I used to wear them underneath my clothes. I got these at the New York Historical Society. They had an anti-slavery exhibition. But now I brought them out in this election year because I just thought they should fully participate in everything that's going on, and I think about them all the time. And Harriet Tubman's words and Sojourner Truth's words guide me every day. Because they were strong women who didn't take any guff about mistreatment of women, and they fought for slavery, against slavery, way before Mr. Lincoln and his Emancipation Proclamation came down. And they never forgot their whole community. I mean, when Harriet Tubman went from Maryland to Pennsylvania, she, was glad to be free, but then she realized that she had an obligation to go back and bring some folk up so that she would not be lonely, and she went back numerous times, brought 300 folk up. And we've got in the middle class, and those of us who have been able to walk through the doors of opportunity, we've got to remember Harriet Tubman and not think it's about us, and really try to lift as we climb. And Sojourner just didn't play around. She talked very eloquently and bluntly, and one of my favorite Sojourner statements one day occurred when she was speaking out against slavery, and she got heckled by an old white man who said, oh, slave woman, I don't care anymore about your anti-slavery talk for an old flea bite. And she snapped back at him and said, that's all right, the Lord willing, I'm going to keep you scratching. And so many people try to be big dogs, and we need to bring about big changes. But I've seen the Flea Corps for Children and Flea Corps for Justice for Children grow. And enough fleas biting strategically can make the biggest dog uncomfortable. And if black women in all these sororities and all these places that we have so many resources and so much power and all these prayer meetings and all these churches, decided they were going to become fleas for Children for Justice. We could change the world and change the country. So I want everybody to know about Sojourner and Harriet and to become a part of that legacy of women just doing what has to be done to save our children.
That was children's advocate Marion Wright Edelman. Her latest book is called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. She joined us here in our studios at NPR West.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.